south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Just lately, I've been getting a lot of emails from people congratulating me. Guess what it's all about? The Cubbies winning the World Series in Chicago. You know, it took them 108 years to do that, right? Anyway, people knowing that I'm from Chicago automatically assume I'm a Cubs fan. I mean, you do have your choice, the Cubs, the White Sox, the Bears, even so-called traitorous Chicagoans who like the Green Bay Packers or Milwaukee, or none of the above. And you know, this might come as a big disappointment to everyone, but I never watched the series, and I just faintly heard they were playing Cleveland because I got so many emails on that one, too. Being that Cleveland's my favorite punching bag and I'm from Chi-Town, people put two and two together, but in this case, it doesn't make four. Sounds like Common Core math, doesn't it? By the way, over the years, I've had radio shows down here in Latin America, in English, of course. And in fact, the name of one of my shows was the Chi-Town Johnny DUI Show. Since I always had the morning or afternoon drive time slot, of course, in English, DUI stands for Driving Under the Influence. And the ads for my show would say, Driving Under the Influence of Johnny. Of course, Latins never got the reference. There's no such thing as DUI down here. Well, technically there is, but, you know, they don't have a point system, so you don't lose points if you're picked up or pulled over for drunk driving. Oh, and that's kind of a misnomer, too. They don't actually pick you up. They kind of sit you down and let you sober up until you can drive or until you're conscious enough so they can hit you up with a bribe. Then they'll generally help you call a relative or friend to drive for you. Unless, of course, you hurt someone other than yourself and they end up in the hospital. Or worse. Then charges will be filed and you'll go down to the police station and all that and have to get your lawyer to get you off. Another reason to stick with the same lawyer. Then he becomes your friend and will answer those 2 in the morning phone calls. Maybe. As long as you don't make a pest out of yourself. So that's the story of what could happen to you if you're drinking and driving down here. By the way, if you live down here long enough, you'll soon realize that Latins like to drink and drive. Latin men, that is. In fact, there have been times when I've pulled up to stop signs and looked over to the car next to me, only to see the driver hoisting a beer or a bottle of booze. However, I've only seen that kind of thing when the driver has his window down, which is not recommended. Normally, windows are up, and they have extreme tinting down here, so you'll never know if the guy next to you is putting one down. But I can tell you this, on Fridays and Saturday evenings, it's daredevil night. You see, a lot of guys you know are drunk because they're weaving in and out of their lane and all over the place. In fact, I saw some statistics recently that said 30% of all accidents are caused by drunk drivers in Latin America. And that same article said 9 out of 10 accidents are caused by male drivers. It's got to be the macho thing. It's no other excuse. Now, a third of the drivers here in Latin America are women, so those statistics say a hell of a lot. And you know, even though every male across the world complains about women drivers, down here in Latin America anyway, they're actually much, much less likely to be the cause of an accident. Yep, men will complain, but again, the truth is stranger than fiction. By the way, in that report it said, the vehicles that are most likely to be involved in accidents as a percentage of their presence or numbers on the road are, number one by far, motorcycles, number two, buses, number three, taxis, number four, get this, cop cars. And strangely enough, down here in Latin America, there are almost no women bus drivers and almost no women motorcyclists. Well, I take that back. I'd say about 1 in 100 motorcyclists are women, and they're usually driving scooters. And the same thing goes for taxis and cop cars. Almost no women drivers. Yep, in those cases, the facts absolutely fit. So in the end, if you can't take the booze out of a Latin or the testosterone out of a Latin male, maybe the best idea for traffic safety would be to have the chicken bus companies recruit women drivers. Because, you know, when a bus crashes down here, it's generally not a little fender bender. It's not unusual to have a few deaths and 30 or 40 people going to the hospital. But I digress as usual. Back to the Cubbies. Now, I'm no fan of organized sports, not at all. However, one-on-one sports like tennis, golf, racing, fine with me, because that's true competition. You against another person. As far as I can see, at least since the golden days of baseball and football, which pretty much ended back in the 70s, team sports have really just been part of bread and circuses. The players have no loyalty to the team. They're just bought and paid for. Like my dad used to say, in the old days, a guy like Hank Aaron, Ernie Banks, Joe DiMaggio were loyal to their teams, and no matter how much another franchise offered them, they most often wouldn't take the better deal because of loyalty to their buddies and the team. Yankees were Yankees, Cubs were Cubs, Dodgers were Dodgers. They'd stay with the original team they were drafted into or first made their mark. But these days, that concept doesn't exist. It's all about the money. I know, I digress. This is a show about Latin America, right? However, I do get a lot of emails from people who, like me, digress and go completely off point. Like a yawn, it's contagious, you know. Yep, they ask me all kinds of things unrelated to Latin America. Lots of love and romance stuff, too. Like I was some kind of Latin Ann Landers. Ana Landres. And I think now, after over 600 shows in the can, I can finally address all those emails I get from people asking me to throw out a few tidbits about my personal life. You know, how did I end up in this business? How did I end up in Latin America? Even way before it was fashionable for gringos to vacation in Costa Rica. Well, it all started for me as dumb luck, fate, and my mother. Because, you know, without my pushy German mother, I could just as easily have ended up as a very slow waiter in a bad Greek restaurant. Did I say bad Greek restaurant? That's redundant, isn't it? At least in Chicago it is. So I'll give you a little personal stuff here. We're three boys in the family. My dad was a 100% sportsman, a jock, pretty good at it too. He was a first-string guard on the Army-Navy basketball team and traveled the world playing the Russians and the Koreans and all that during the Cold War. That was around 1950. Out of the Army, drafted by an East Coast professional baseball team. Played a couple years there. In fact, I have his rookie card. After he got kicked down to the farm team, came back to Chicago, got a real job, but couldn't get baseball out of his system. So weeknights, he played in fast-pitch bar leagues in Chicago. He broke all the bar league hitting records and still holds some even years after his death. Because of that, he never had to buy a drink, an Italian sausage, or a kielbasa in any bar in Chicago. That said, when he had his three boys, man, they were going to be sports heroes too. However, my German mother, a professor with a master's and PhD, she had other ideas and said, John, I want one of those kids. By the way, what a combo, huh? A sports guy, high school dropout, and a PhD. These days, that stuff just doesn't happen. She selected me, put me in music classes in third grade, enrolled me in what they called the Great Books Club. Had to read two classic books a week with written book reports and all, and that lasted a couple of years. Played for years in a symphony orchestra. Pushed on quite easily to rock and roll instruments, much to my mother's disdain. But you know, back then, before the word nerd was coined, cello players did not attract girls. Turns out I was pretty handy and good at mathematics. Got a full boat engineering scholarship, and off I went. Thank you, Mom, for that. Meanwhile, as for my two sports-minded brothers, one of them was such a good baseball player, he got drafted onto the U.S. All-Star Little League team when he was 12 and traveled the world playing the Japanese and the Koreans, etc. Kind of like a junior version of my dad. Then he went on to become state powerlifting champion. And my other brother, such a good hockey player and goalie that he was scouted by the National Hockey League in high school. They were ready to sign him, but he blew out his knee and was washed up by the time he was 20. No NHL for him. And now, 50 years old, a wreck, arthritis everywhere, on multiple prescription meds slated for knee replacements he doesn't want to get. And the other brother, former baseball guy, laments and whines every time I talk to him. He says, Johnny, I don't get it. Why did Mom take you and not me? Why wasn't I the kid that got the music, the art, and the culture instead of the sports? By the way, he, also around 50 years old, is on a bunch of meds and has had heart stents already. Both have had weight problems. One, severely obese for a while. Lost 135 pounds in 6 months after he was diagnosed with that heart problem. So the one good thing he says he got from sports was discipline. They've all got that, right? If they can put down the pizza, get off the couch, go to the gym, and do something about it. You know, I started this little off-topic rant by saying a lot of people sent me congratulatory emails about the Cubbies' victory. Now, you have to know, with a father like mine, he dragged us all to as many Cubs, Sox, Bears, Braves, and Green Bay Packer games as he could afford to get tickets for. And I remember once I asked my dad, what was the best game you ever saw? Here was a guy who'd seen it all and had known many of the famous players, too. He said in 1940, when he was just 11 or 12 years old, he said he went to a game that he still has dreams about. Back then, he said, every year at Wrigley Field, they had an exhibition game benefiting Mount Sinai Hospital. He said he got some dugout seats for a game that was called The Comedians versus the Leading Men. Now pay attention here and see if any of this clicks. The comedians on the team were, get this, Jack Benny, Fred Allen, Andy Devine, Buster Keaton, Abbott and Costello, and the Three Stooges, versus the leading men. And they were Gary Cooper, Tyrone Power, Errol Flynn, Fred Astaire, Randolph Scott, John Wayne, Roy Rogers, and Peter Lorre. How did my dad remember all those names? He didn't have to. He bought a scorecard. You know, get your scorecards here. Can't tell a player's without a scorecard. Has to be worth a lot of money now, but like my old Superman comic books, can't find them anymore. You know how that stuff ends up in the attic and then in the trash after some spring cleaning. You know that drill. Too bad, huh? Anyway, he said there was a capacity crowd at the time, 37,500 at Wrigley Field in Chicago, August 8th, 1940. But that's not all. Paulette Goddard, Charlie Chaplin's wife, was the captain of the comedians team. And Marlena Dietrich, the captain of the leading men team. And get this. The announcer, Milton Berle. And the umpires, the Marx Brothers, Chico Harpo and Groucho. Now, the highlight of the whole game, according to my dad, was when Boris Karloff hit a home run, dressed as the Frankenstein monster. And because he could only walk like Frankenstein, he had a pinch runner.
Bela Lugosi, Dracula himself, I want to wipe your windows.
Though neither Karloff nor Lugosi were on the printed scorecard, they were there. In the end, the leading men team beat the comedians by 5-3. Now, I bet most of you young listeners out there don't know who the hell I'm talking about. But you guys and gals over 50, you sure do. Now, imagine them trying to put something like that together these days. It just would never happen for a million and one reasons, not the least of which insurance liability problems. What would happen if, for example, Kim Kardashian was playing second base? Meanwhile, Katy Perry hits into a double play. Nicki Minaj slides into second, blows an implant, and spikes Kardashian's ass. Literally. There'd be hell to pay, million-dollar lawsuits, and everyone would end up on botched. Would you pay to see that? But where were we? Oh yeah, we were talking about me, my past, and how I got here. My dad didn't say much, but I do remember him saying once, after he got out of the sports game himself and became a professional armchair quarterback, he used to say, both success and failure have 1,000 fathers. I'm sure you didn't make that up, but it's a pretty good old saying, isn't it? Meaning, of course, everything you did in your life up to now, every right turn, left turn, every door you opened, every one you closed, led you to exactly where you are today, listening to this show. If anywhere along your past lifeline you would have made a left turn instead of a right, overslept instead of underslept, made the decision to drive through a yellow light instead of stopping at one or vice versa, you wouldn't be listening to this show right now. You would have, from that moment on, split off on a completely different life path. So congratulations to you. You've made it this far. You're on the right track. You're intelligent, able, and willing to accept new things because, well, you're actively thinking about a plan B, while probably 99 of 100 Americans are surely in a few short months going to take it on the chin. And speaking of long-shot dark horse winners, how about Trump? He won. Which is having vast repercussions down here in Latin America, at least for a day or two. That's how things go. People here have very short memories. Sound familiar? Anyway, the night of elections and the next day, every single Latin TV station had man-on-the-street interviews with mostly illegal aliens up in the States getting their gauge on things. And they were just shocked. Bloodless, ashen-faced, wondering what happened, what's going to happen next, and if Trump's really going to kick them out and build that wall. If he's going to deport all those illegal aliens up there, there really is a very easy and foolproof way to find out who these people are, where they live, and basically get all their debts. Just post an immigration officer at all the Western Union's in quick money transfer offices. Because in some Latin countries, up to a third of their income comes from the United States. Illegal aliens, mostly, working in the States and shipping money back by Western Union and other convenient wire transferring outfits. Oddly enough, the vast majority of which located in Latin neighborhoods. And if you think I'm being harsh here, remember, every single bank outside the U.S. has to send to the IRS your bank movements if you happen to have an account there. So U.S. Big Brother is intent on tracking all of us who are outside the country. Why shouldn't they be tracking the monetary movements of the illegal aliens up there? Just doesn't make sense, does it? And I know there'll be some wishy-washy, whiny do-gooders who will say, Johnny, you've got no sympathy, you haven't got a heart. But hear me for a second. I devote a lot of time on this show talking about how to get permanent and temporary residency here in Latin America. And you know, you just can't sneak in and live in one of these Latin countries. Well, I take that back. Off the Gringo Tourist Trail, you can do that practically forever. However, in order to become a legal resident in the country, you have to prove income. You have to prove you're a good citizen with police reports. You have to hire a lawyer to do that. You have to spend some money. You have to wade through the bureaucracy. And if you come in as a tourist, you have to leave the country every 90 days. In other words, every single Latin country has put up its own barriers and bureaucratic red tape to prevent the uneducated masses, riffraff, criminals, whatever, from coming down and setting up shop in their country. In fact, if you happen to be in Mexico illegally, you've overstayed your visa or you somehow snuck in and you get picked up by the federales, you will not be treated as an honored guest. And if a Latin country sees you've been in their country illegally, when you try to get out, you have to pay a fine. It's not stiff, but you still have to pay a couple of bucks every day you overstay your visa. And if you came in without a visa at all, that means sneaking in through a border, and you get picked up, you'll go straight to jail. And that'll be just the beginning of your trouble. You see where I'm headed here? Latin countries only want educated people who can support themselves. They specifically state in their residency rules and regs, to get permanent residency, unless you marry a local, you have to have your own source of outside funding to maintain your lifestyle. They don't want you to be taking any jobs from the locals. So then why is it just the opposite when it comes to Uncle Sam, Big Brother, in the first world? In fact, let me read you something from a couple of U.S. government documents stating how difficult it was to get into the United States as an immigrant just until a few years ago. These are from the Immigration and Quota Acts from around 1930. It says here, in 1929, the United States had adopted an annual immigration quota ceiling of 153,774 per year. Do you get that? 153,000. Then it says, on September 8, 1930, right after the great crash in October of that year, when widespread U.S. unemployment and the influx of refugees prompted President Hoover to resurrect what they call the, quote, public charge clause. It says, from then on, consular officials in the United States were instructed to judge whether an immigration applicant was, quote, likely to become a public charge at any time, even if long after arriving. President Hoover reminded them that they must possess sufficient resources to support themselves for an indefinite period of time without employment. At one time, it says here, an immigrant with $100 could gain entry into the United States. That would be around $3,000 in today's U.S. funny money. And it says, under Section 7 of the Act of 1924, American consular officials, that is, embassy personnel, also required immigration applicants to provide police certificates of good conduct from their home countries, along with passports, birth, marriage, and health certificates, as well as all available public records from their country of origin. People trying to immigrate to the U.S. also encountered yet another hurdle called a contract labor provision, which in law denies admission to those under employment contracts. The Immigration Act also excludes persons whose ticket or passage is paid for by another, either directly or indirectly. After 1930, the immigration law said immigrants were expected to be self-sufficient, capable of supporting themselves, and prepared to pay their own passage without accepting help from friends. Then it says after 1930, diligent enforcement of the quota restrictions sharply curtailed the number of unqualified newcomers. The number of immigrants admitted to the U.S. fell from 241,700 in 1930 to 97,139 in 31, 35,576 in 1932. Now, those were the Depression years, when times were tough and the U.S. had an isolationist policy. According to experts, you know, the United States is in depression right now. And by some estimates, there are over 40 million people in the United States illegally at this very moment. Nearly all of them Latinos. So what's the point? Well, as it turns out, Latin American countries want immigrants, but they only want this particular refugee profile. They want middle or upper middle class, primarily business-oriented, first world people. They want professionals in white-collar, well-educated, city-dwelling, cosmopolitan, generally older, or retired first-world citizens with an outside income. Now, contrast that with the U.S. immigration policies today. Hey, I'm just saying, you got third-world countries here in Latin America with first-world immigrants trickling in, but almost all of them coming in legally. But we were talking about the Trump win, right? And how Latins down here feel about it. Well, I can tell you this, expats in Mexico are kind of skittish and worried. There are even articles in English being posted in expat rags like this one with the title, U.S. Expats in Mexico Fear Retaliation Now That Trump is President. Paraphrasing, it says, many of the more than 1.5 million people from the United States currently living in Mexico say they are worried about the future and what might happen to them. It says, most Americans in Mexico live in towns so saturated with gringos that most of the street signs are in both English and Spanish. Like, for example, the town of Jajic, located in the state of Nuevo León. It says, despite the calm of the life lived by many of the Americans in this little town of less than 10,000 people, most of who are retired, some of them fear, now that Trump has won, Mexico's government might act out against them in some way. They're playing the waiting game now. In fact, many long-term U.S. residents in Mexico are thinking now about requesting a Mexican passport so that the government can't, quote, confiscate their houses in the future. Whoa. Okay, it's me again. By the way, if you have just permanent or temporary residency in a foreign country and you have property there registered in your name, it is feasible that your new Latin government can change the rules anytime, especially if under economic duress. And they could possibly confiscate your property. It's happened before in socialist countries, you know. Like, for example, that basket case, Venezuela. However, if you're a naturalized citizen and you have a passport, you have all the rights of a regular citizen and they can't do that to you. And of course, that's why a lot of gringos have an SA corporation own their property. So you own the corporation owns the property. The corporation, as you know, is like a person. It can open bank accounts and own property and such, which makes owning property as airtight as being a national and having a passport and owning property. And you know, I'm often perplexed as to why so many gringos living in Mexico don't get their naturalization and passport. I mean, all they have to do is wait 5 years and have their permanent residency, and they can apply for nationalization. So why not go the extra step and get the passport if you qualify? A second passport offers so many advantages to a gringo. And then I found out by hook and crook some of the reasons why people don't do it. It's because, according to Mexican law, to get that passport, you have to have a good and basic knowledge of Spanish and Mexican history, and they'll give you a test on it when you apply for citizenship. Just the reverse compared to the States, where immigrants take an oath in English and have to know some American history. However, then I found out the test you take for citizenship in Mexico is a multiple choice test and the answers are posted on the internet. So, duh. Typical, huh? But you know, if you're familiar with gringos living in Mexico, you know they mostly live amongst other gringos and the vast majority never seem to get beyond kitchen Spanish, enough to get a few things across to their maids. That's problem number one when living amongst gringos. Even though I'll often hear gringos in Mexico say, Johnny, I don't live on the gringo tourist trail. Well, then just take a walk with me to the nearest Walmart and we'll count those pasty white pale legs and sunburned noses in the junk food aisle. In my neck of the woods, I'm talking really off the gringo tourist trail here, I can go to any Walmart within an hour's drive and normally not see a single gringo. Though on occasion, I'll see a few kumbaya do-gooders with matching t-shirts. And yes, I try to be superficially nice to them. You ever notice they don't like to make eye contact? That's weird, huh? So anyway, I just don't understand why so many gringos living in Mexico, been there for over 5 years, they've got their permanent residency, yet somehow most of them are just not tuned in to what's happening up in the States. Or they'd be beating down the immigration office doors to get that passport going. Then just recently I ran into another gringo living in Mexico. He says people he knows just don't do it because they go back and forth to the States a lot. And as it turns out, if you leave Mexico more than 2 years in the last 5 years before you apply for your passport, then you'll have to start the clock running again and make sure you're not out of the country for more than 2 years in the last 5 year period. And he said you can lose your residency if you're out of the country more than 6 months a year. So basically, if you're a permanent resident in Mexico for 5 years or more, you can apply for a passport. However, the point is, very few gringos with permanent residency go ahead and do that. And really, that should be a top priority for gringos. Now, oddly enough, wherever you find big concentrations of gringos in Latin America, you'll find almost none of them talking about getting passports and naturalization. They're content to be permanent residents. Which sort of makes sense in a twisted way because you'll meet Americans down here who are flag-waving Republicans and Democrats. By the way, now that Trump's won in the States, Mexico's Secretary of Foreign Relations announced that Mexico has a defensive strategy of containment. And he said that Mexico has already identified actions they'll take should the U.S. violate North American free trade agreements that were signed by previous U.S. administrations, and you know who they are. He also said Mexico will defend bilateral relations established through the NAFTA treaty, despite Trump's claims that NAFTA was not a legitimate agreement. We'll soon see how that goes. Like the song says, battle lines are being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. You'll show your age if you know who did that song. Okay, we're nearing the end. Don't forget, I have a couple of spots left open for my January 2017 Expat Insiders Seminar being held in and around Guatemala, Central America, mostly way off the gringo tourist trail. We'll visit some of my very favorite spots. Just go to www.thenewexpat.com, click on Johnny's 2017 seminar link, and you're there.
South of the border.
This is the Expat Files, living in Latin America. If you want me to help you out with your own Plan B, just schedule a one-on-one consult. Send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to learn how to move forward with your own Plan B from right up there in the States, go to www.expatplanb.com and check out my three videos. See ya. Nos vemos.